Laura picked this paper out of several I sent her. So this is something that's from quite a few years ago, actually, and has been a kind of topic I've not worked systematically on, I suppose. It, as Ulrika says, my sort of day job is clinically with young people with psychotic illness, and my scientific work is in the kind of scans that Sophie and Lois presented, so fMRI in mental illness is my normal work. But I guess I have a kind of interest in philosophy of psychiatry as well. And this response was to a paper by a colleague in Aberdeen, Martin Wiley, who did a philosophy PhD, was very interested in Merleau-Ponty and depression. So he did his PhD with Eric Matthews in Aberdeen. Okay, so this is, as I said, this is before I got involved with the Beckett and neuroscience group. But some of the ideas developed in this article, I hope that maybe Liz and I will come back to. And I guess the only academic work I've done on Beckett to date has been a collaboration with Johnny Heron about, as Liz mentioned, about Rough for Theatre 2. And I guess that came out of an interest, a perverse interest I have in the early Heidegger and his background. And it just struck me that there was a similarity between Beckett's reading of Bindelband and perhaps the influence of the neo-Kantianism in the early phenomenological tradition and thought of Martin Heidegger. A philosophical movement, I guess, that's pretty much vanished to most people, at least in the UK, or who do courses in philosophy as undergraduates. But as I say, what I'm going to talk about is the paper that Laura circulated. So my plan was only to talk very briefly. So I've got a few things I want to bring out from the paper, which are the things that occur to me that may be of interest or remain of interest to me from it. And then I was going to sort of pause there. Either we can go straight to questions, or I've got some more material that I guess relates to a more recent project. So the last, I was whinging about it, over the last 8 years I've been involved in a reader of phenomenological psychiatry that's coming out in September, which we sort of started off with a kind of, you know, glad heart, thinking this is going to be very straightforward, but because it involved a lot of permissions from various publishers across the world, lots of new translations, it's taken a lot longer, a lot more work than we intended. And at the end of it, it made us think, well, is there a point to thinking phenomenologically about patients? And I think some of the themes that came to us resonates with the talk we had from Professor Oppenheim and Malibu earlier on, is about notions of meaning when you have substantial mental illness, and how far can it help us? What does it do for us as clinicians and as researchers? Very real question, because in this day and age, psychiatry is very biologically driven. Just scan the heads, just look at the genes. Okay, so if I start off from the paper. So this is what I may talk about, is the themes from the paper that we've had circulated. My kind of understanding of what phenomenology is, how it might be used in clinical practice, a bit about Heideggerian developments or movements from there. And a guy called Minkowski, who's a very famous phenomenological psychiatrist influenced by not only Husserl and Heidegger, but also Bergson, and his view of how one should do psychopathology and understand patients. So if I start with the paper, I guess there are a couple of things that still occur to me. And as I say, I'm very happy for you guys to interrupt and say if anything you want to talk about more. So one thing that struck me in Wilder's paper, to which I responded, was his idea of using time as a kind of central structure where he pinned around his analysis of depression. And it's something that always appeals to me, and where I think phenomenology helps. It's something that Minkowski talks about in great detail, and I'll come on to slightly have time. Andreasen is a contemporary. So Nancy Andreasen is a probably retired professor now in Iowa, and she's one of those quirky figures in psychiatry whose first PhD was in poetry, John Donne, and then developed being a very biological scientific psychiatrist. And Andreasen's important is because she was one of the task force of the DSM-3 and 4. And Andreasen wrote a very nice paper a few years ago called DSM-4 and the Death of Phenomenology, which is basically lamenting the unintended consequence of the DSM-4. So she would say that there's a sort of, not only any of you who know psychiatric classification or diagnostic systems, it's very much if you have three of these and don't have this, then X. it's what's called operationalized systems. It's you follow a set of rules and you come out with a diagnosis. And Andreasen says this has led to an atomistic conception of psychopathology. It's maybe slightly different to what we talked about in the last talk. That atomism means a wholeness. She means a kind of fragmentary notion of psychopathology where each symptom is a standalone entity, doesn't connect meaningfully with the rest of it. And I guess the other thing she sort of mentions in the paper was an educational problem with this. So all, she claims, American psychiatrists think exists is what's in the DSM-4. That is the totalizing, hegemonic, epistemological force of psychopathology. And she regrets it. She was an author of it. You know, we didn't really intend to unleash this on you guys. As I say, she's a very, you know, sensible lady and very good researcher. So I guess that's the theme that I find I'm very sympathetic to in Wiley's paper, in which I try and reflect my commentary, this idea of a return to notions of coherence and holism and abnormal mental states, and not thinking of these discrete abnormalities such as, you know, poor sleep, poor appetite, like we go for a checklist of depression. And the other area that, I guess there are two areas that I sort of subsequently explored. One was about empirical data on time distortion and mental illness, which back when I wrote this in, whenever it was, probably 2003 or 4, there was very little around and seemed to be not much since. But it's something that, again, people are getting more and more interested in. And for those of you who are interested in this area, there's a recent book by Claudia Hammond called Time Watching, about disorders of time perception and time experience in both normal and abnormal psychology. And also the discrepant views on how we experience time or how we represent time in the nervous system. And in the paper, I think I mentioned papers by Dawson, Ivry and Spence, Lewis and Muir and Glickson, and all the different accounts of different types of clock, not being a unitary function depending on the task in hand, etc. And the account that appealed to me most at that time, and still to some extent, is one of Glickson. I spent a bit of time explaining in the paper. I think mainly because it fits quite nicely with the phenomenological account of Husserl and Heidegger, amongst others. So in the paper, I try and summarise Glickson's study, and he in turn claims that he gives an account that's more true to experience. And he would suggest that the experience of time is due to two factors, the number of subjective temporal units and their duration, and those two can both be modified independently. And he says that there are two factors that alter them. One is the direction, if you will, of attention. So that alters the size of the time units. And he claims that arousal alters the number. And he gives us his limiting step, a contemplative meditative stance, where you have very low arousal and internal attention. So you have a decreased number of time units and an increase in their duration. And this is where, I guess, again, it links to Professor Oppenheim's talk, this is the kind of state we would try to access in a kind of resting state fMRI study. So no active cognitive tasks going on. And I guess I point out that maybe we can think about pathological states that might be similar to this in Glickson's account, such as depression, where we know there is a marked internal attention due to self-negativity, but also a sort of practical internal attention due to a lack of immersion in the world. So that was the sort of the neuroscience and clinical elements of time distortion. And the other area that still confuses me, and I guess it links back to the theme of this whole series of workshops, really, the relationship between, I guess, Beckett and Brain on one hand, but in this account, the relationship between experience and neuroscience. So, So, I probably got trained in that top paradigm, I want to call it cognitive neuroscience, cognitive neuropsychiatry. This is a kind of paradigm that, in my day, was exemplified by people like Chris Frith, so Sophie's former colleague at the Institute of Neurology, Tony David at my Institute of Psychiatry, where I used to work, Halligan in Cardiff, and it's a very kind of, very neat story. So the idea is, psychopathology is due to an abnormality in normal psychological processes. Those psychological processes are in turn instantiated in particular neural systems. Okay? So an example that I've worked on would be hearing voices, so auditory hallucinations. So hearing voices are due to the normal phenomenon of recognising one's own self, self-speech gone awry. So we don't tag our own internal speech as ours, so hence it appears phenomenally as being other, and we can link that with the abnormality in neural circuitry. Okay, so that's the kind of paradigm that a lot of contemporary psychopathology works in. And the same, this example runs with work like Richard Blair on psychopaths, looking at facial recognition of affect, autism and theory of the mind, etc. And then we have this nice phrase. I think people like it, neurophenomenology, which again came around the late 90s, early 2000s. And I wasn't ever quite sure, and I still am not entirely quite sure what this is, but I thought, being as somebody who is sympathetic towards obviously neuroscience and phenomenology, I should like it. So I was keen to know what it was. And this is where I still get into little ruts. So I will read out Varela's definition, and you can tell me what you think. This is from 98. It's in the paper, page 190. So Varela says, the working hypothesis of neurophenomenology, that phenomenological accounts of the structure of experience and their counterparts in cognitive science relate to each other through reciprocal constraints. And that, to me, didn't sound too different to what my colleagues had told me cognitive neuroscience was. So in the old days, I mentioned, make this point briefly in the paper, we didn't really have neuroscience, we had cognitive science. It's driven by linguistic theory, AI. It was meant to be substance neutral, so you have this idea of functionalism, so it's not about whether material or mental state is instantiated in. But then with the advents in the neuroscience, the neuro got put back in again, and this idea of reciprocal constraints became apparent. So we wanted to know the psychological data, but also wanted to know how the brain could make that happen. And your theory was bounded by both kind of realms. So it echoed slightly with Varela's quote. So this idea of mutual constraint between something about subjectivity and something about biology. But Varela makes the point that, again, we touched on this today already about narrativity with maybe brain damage. So Varela says that there's something about you having to be trained and disciplined. I think I put it there, not lay. So the data that Varela wants is not just the data any of us can give. It's something that he claims a phenomenologist, ever such a exotic person is, gives. And that's something that troubles me slightly, because in my clinical area, obviously, we're interested in experience of mental illness, and very few of our patients can't give us this detail and haven't got the ability to do that. But yet, we do see in phenomenological psychiatry these very detailed accounts that I'm always a bit sceptical of. So those of you who may know the work of Louis Saz, he has Schreiber, Antoine Artaud, and that's probably about it, who are the exemplars of psychotic processes. But we lack the kind of generalizable data that would be most helpful. Okay, so that's my a brief comment there about the relationship between neurophenomenology and cognitive neuroscience. And then the next section of the paper was really a very brief review of how philosophers have thought about time. Sort of skating very, very briefly over Bergson and Deleuze, and about three lines probably, and more detail on Husserl and Heidegger and Levinas. And I guess this sort of appealed to me at the time. It had some clinical resonances. So Levinas, in his work, I think it's Time and the Other, is critical about the kind of predictability and the synchronous nature of Husserl's account of time, and claims there is more indeterminacy of our experience of time than Husserl gives it credit for. And I think his exemplar state, and Catherine may correct me, is listening to music. There's a bit of predictability in the rhythm and a pattern to it. Levinas's exemplar is one of kind of messy social relations with family dying, being born, being living apart. She has a much more chaotic exemplar for his sort of experiment, his thought experiment, and claims that due to this, there's a more unpredictability of the future. And this, of course, underpins what Levinas is sort of famous for is that the other is always very different to ourselves, the radical alterity of the other. And I guess this is where I saw it slightly linked with the previous work I discussed on time. So Levinas allows this flux, this chaos, this randomness to be there, and he claims the default structure of time. But we know in depression there is a very real attempt to foreclose this randomness. The future becomes less obvious, more closed off, and also more predictable. I think I cited some data there to support that. So I guess my sort of concluding remarks here, whether there was in depression, the kind of openness to the future that characterises Levinas thinking on time gets a bit more foreclosed and becomes a bit more unsurly in its predictability, which is where, as I say, Wiley argues is the core of a depressive experience and the features of pessimism and lack of hope that can characterise the disorder when severe.